Please be seated. Well, good afternoon. My notes tell me that we have students from Wanakee High School here. If that's true, will you all please stand with your advisors or teachers? Oh my, very good group. Well, thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here on a program that the court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they have had the opportunity to have some of the materials on the case before they arrived today. Were you here over the lunch hour and have a chance to talk to Justice Abraham's son when she was on? Oh, very good. That's great.
I recognize you all.
All right, well, I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to me, of course, you know, Justice Shirley Abraham's son. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the left, Justice Daniel Kelly. With those brief remarks, are we set to begin, counsel? Okay, please do.
Members of the court and opposing counsel, we're here today because the legislature amended Chapter 980 following this court's decision in Aarons, which I remember very well, written by Justice Gableman, which determined that there was a two-step process necessary in order for somebody who had been committed under Chapter 980 to seek a discharge trial. The first part of the process, better known as Step 1, is that there's sufficient facts in the petition by which somebody, a judge or jury could find somebody who was no longer a sexually violent person. Second part being that the record as a whole or evidence presented by the petitioner or the 980 respondent was sufficient. The legislature in Act 84, which took place or which became effective the day after Mr. Carter submitted his petition, changed the standard on both of those items from the standard of could be found and not no longer a sexually violent person to a situation where he was required to prove that he more likely than not would not be a sexually violent person. It greatly increased the burden upon a Chapter 98 patient who was seeking discharge from his commitment. The issue in this case was how you interpreted the legislature's new statute or criteria, namely that the state took the position that the criteria meant that the judges that looked at their cases could now weigh the evidence that was presented by the person discharged under Chapter 9, or the seeking discharge under Chapter 980, to the other individuals or other evidence that was in the record that might show that they still were a sexually violent person. We took the position that making that sort of change, looked at all the evidence and allowed a judge to engage in weighing, was unconstitutional. We also took the position that the statute should not be applied to Carter because his petition was in the pipeline, having been filed the day before Act 84 became effective. The case that this court heard this morning regarding Mr. Hager was filed after the effective date of Chapter 84, and also he took a position which the Court of Appeals largely approved, namely that in this new process of determining whether or not there was evidence on the record from which a judge or jury would likely to conclude that somebody was no longer a sexually violent person, that you could look at you didn't have to take the whole record, you didn't have to weigh the evidence that had been presented by state evaluators with that presented by respondent evaluators, but you could see whether or not there was evidence in the record that could do that. In effect, parsing out evidence that could support a situation where somebody could get a trial with a petition that supported discharge, even if there was petitions by the state in which opposed it, which was the regular annual evaluation, and Hager had.
Counsel, is it correct?
Hager had that as well.
Counsel? Counsel?
The evaluation in the Hager case was done by Dr. Wakefield, used the MATS evaluation criteria and also looked at some problems with the static 99R, which is an actuarial instrument. Yes.
Is it your position that there is a constitutional violation here because the right to a discharge trial vested before the act took place or took effect, or is it that it violates that there is a vested right to a discharge trial, and this act, by its substance, violates that right?
It's our position that this is unconstitutional because by the substance of what the legislature enacted, it makes it so difficult to get a discharge trial that it violates due process. The vesting goes to the retroactivity of this and how you analyze it under Trinity Petroleum. So it's our position that it should not have been applied to this case because as of the date the petition was filed, that Mr. Carter had a vested interest in being able to be discharged under this criteria. And we think it's a vested right because this involves personal liberty and not just application of monetary sanctions for filing a frivolous lawsuit, which is what the Trinity Petroleum case was about.
All right. So if we're talking about due process, at what point does the right to a discharge trial vest?
The right to a discharge trial, I guess, vests for purposes of the retroactivity when it's in effect at the time a petition is filed. I think under a general constitutionality analysis, if Act 84 applies to Carter, it would apply to him. The question would be, I think, whether or not the criteria are so onerous and so makes it so difficult for him to get a trial the way that it's applied, that violation of due process. Now, it's our position that what the Court of Appeals did regarding Hager in saying that you could find that somebody was more likely than not to be discharged in a Chapter 90 trial, looking at evidence favoring the petitioner and not necessarily evidence that was opposed to it, would still meet constitutional muster. If you follow the interpretation of 980, I think that the Court of Appeals applied. Now, the Court of Appeals made a remark regarding our presentation in that case that we had, in fact, conceded that Mr. Carter could not get a discharge under the new statute. That was applied. Our position was based on the idea that the courts were going to follow the position of the state that the trial courts could weigh evidence and that therefore they could take evidence, not only what Carter might have submitted in the Litton report, but also evidence of state evaluations that opposed Mr. Carter being able to get a discharge from the staff in 98.
Counsel, only if you're finished. Counsel, on page 21 of your brief, you have the third argument or issue in capital letters bold. And it says as follows, 2013 Act 84, if read to allow weighing contrary to Aaron's, was unconstitutional because by increasing Carter's burden of production, it denied Carter effective access to the courts and due process. I understood by that heading that your argument asserting constitutional infirmity was based on the contingency or premise, if read to allow weighing of evidence. Does everything after page 21 in this section fall? Your constitutional challenge renders moot if weighing is not allowed?
It does. If weighing is not allowed, I'd have to agree that there is sufficient due process to meet constitutional muster. I mean, the burden of proving unconstitutionality is beyond a reasonable doubt and is a very heavy one for somebody who makes that assertion. If the only change is that the evidence that has to favor a trial shows that it's more likely than not that the petitioner would be able to prevail. I think that provides sufficient opportunity for a trial that would not violate due process. So I think I was surprised pleasantly, I think, of the decision of the Court of Appeals. And in fact, we changed our whole position on that issue once we knew how the Court of Appeals thought that Chapter 98092 ought to be interpreted.
But what survives vis-a-vis your constitutional challenge is still this retroactive application. Am I correct?
Correct. Retroactivity is a whole separate issue. And I realize there's substantial argument against that this is a procedural change rather than substantive. It's our position that having gotten this petition in the day before Chapter 84, or excuse me, Act 84 is effective, that Mr. Carter at that point had a right to have it decided under that criteria. And the change, especially if you follow the weighing of evidence was so substantial, I would say that it amounted to a vested right. If the only change is that the court can look at evidence and take out or just parse out evidence in its finding that is favorable to a Chapter 980 patient and not necessarily weigh it against evidence that might go against a 980 patient, it's not really a substantive change that is so great that would give Mr. Carter a vested right in the statute as it was the day that he filed his petition.
One of the arguments advanced is that it wasn't a vested right because it was, if you will, contingent upon how the court's going to rule in the future when a petition for discharge is made. Can you respond to that argument that it's not vested because it's contingent?
Well, the whole question was the opportunity to get a trial in the first place before an impartial fact finder, whether it was a judge or a jury. The criteria by which that it was going to be evaluated, whether he got a trial or not, was changed so drastically by Act 84, the way it was being interpreted by the state to require weighing of evidence, that made it unconstitutional and a vested right to use the old criteria for Mr. Carter, who got his petition in the day before the new law became effective.
Counsel, the state takes the position that although the court may not weigh the evidence presented to it, it can compare it. What is your position on the difference between weighing and comparing?
My first position is that I'm not sure what it means. That may well be what the court says as well. The only thing I can conceive of is that it means that you can look at the state's evidence to see if perhaps the science that's promulgated in the evidence presented by the 980 patient has as a basis in scientific literature or something like that, or whether they're using similar methodology. That's basically what I can get out of that particular phraseology that the state presented.
Now, the current version of 980.09 says four times that the responsibility of the court is to determine whether a court or jury would find that the committed person would be likely, that it would be likely that a jury would find they don't meet the standards for commitment. Doesn't that require the court to engage in some manner of prediction about what a court or a jury hearing the case would do?
To some extent, it might be a prediction to have to look at that. But I think what it means, at least under the Court of Appeals and also Hager's position, is that if you take evidence on the record favoring a respondent and has a reasonable scientific and factual basis, that a judge or jury, given the fact the burden is on the state by clearly the evidence at a discharge trial, that a judge or jury would find the person not to be a sexually violent person. Now, certainly I think the court could do that and still understand that the state has its experts that it would present that would argue to the contrary, and perhaps he's not the 90 respondent is not going to prevail at trial. So the court's role, if you follow the position taken by the Court of Appeals and by Hager, is very similar to what it was under Aaron's, a somewhat higher burden of production being placed on the 980 patient that's petitioning for discharge.
Would it be reasonable, do you think, to read the difference in the old and new versions of the statute to say that in the old version, the standard was whether the jury would have permission to find in favor of the petitioner, right? That is, there is evidence sufficient to go to the jury for them to consider whether that should convince them that the person no longer meets the standard for commitment, versus the new, which is not permission but prediction, and therefore necessarily involves weighing of the evidence. Right. So even if we look at this as just raising the bar, doesn't that require the court to weigh the evidence that is asserted in favor of the petitioner to see if it meets that bar?
I don't think the court so much weighs the evidence as compares it to what was presented at the last fact-finding hearing to see if that, you know, would change the mind of a reasonable judge or jury. So,
well, now the could and the would, those are substantially different, right? Because could would be, that's just the measure of the quantum of evidence necessary to exist to send it to a trial, right? So the jury can get the case. The would is the prediction. I think a jury looking at this evidence would find that he no longer meets the terms for commitment. Isn't that the difference?
I think there is a difference. The big problem I have with the comparison is that in this type of case, there's no such thing as, you know, summary judgment against someone that petitions to be discharged from the Chapter 980 commitment unless the person fails to meet the criteria in 1 and 2. Perhaps that even amounts to something against a 980 respondent. For example, somebody files a petition saying, I'm a better person than I was when I got committed under 980. That's certainly not sufficient under subsection 1. That was clear from Aaron's. The second one is when someone presents a report from a doctor that considers basically the evidence that was presented at the first trial or last fact-finding hearing regarding the case, but doesn't really present anything new that's different in terms of the research or in terms of the person's behavior. And you have to have more than the person's behavior, as this court found in Tally that it released earlier this year. So I would say there is some difference. As I said, it's an increased burden of production. And some matter of a judge predicting how a judge or a jury might react to it, but the judge doesn't put his own personal judgment on the facts as to what he personally would actually do based on that evidence.
So am I to take it then that the position should be that the court considers only that evidence that is – let me back up, I'm sorry. Should the rule be that the court may only rely on that evidence that is presented that supports the petitioner's position? And may not rely on evidence that detracts from that position.
I think that's what the court should do to ensure that somebody committed to Chapter 980 has this opportunity for trial. There certainly is within that possibility a judge might reject an expert report because it's based on old facts or unproven science.
So let's say it's not old facts, it's not unproven, it's just conflicting. Right? So the defendant or the petitioner puts in his expert report, state puts in theirs. They're both looking at the new evidence, and they disagree about its import. Is the court supposed to simply set aside the state's report and not rely on that in determining whether a jury would likely find that the person no longer meets the terms of commitment?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
What remedy are you asking for on remand? What's the instruction? Probably more correctly stated, sure. Asked. What's the instruction on remand?
On remand, I frankly agree with the state that Judge Kelly should reevaluate whether or not Mr. Carter is entitled to a trial based upon the correct reading of 98092.
How do you reconcile that instruction with the instruction of the Court of Appeals in Hager, which on remand indicated that a discharge trial should be conducted?
I think the difference is that in Hager, he argued consistently based upon his interpretation of 98092, which the Court of Appeals basically accepted as compared to our position that the language was not amenable to the sort of saving construction that the Court of Appeals placed on it that was similar to what Hager had argued for. So Hager and Mr. Carter took different positions as to whether or not there was a saving construction, and Mr. Carter's case was never evaluated on the saving construction.
How do you write these two cases so they're consistent?
How do you rank them?
Yeah, how would this court write these two cases so that the result is consistent? The reason we're hearing them together, when I say together, on the same day, even though they've been separated, so that you hear two cases that raise similar or the same issue so that the court comes out the same way, right?
Sure.
So that the lawyers and the litigants understand what's happening.
Sure. Hager's case and the facts of it were never evaluated under the new criteria that was set forth by the Court of Appeals. And, of course, Carter's case was never evaluated under that criteria. Hager's case was. And so rather than this court deciding whether under this criteria that Carter should get a trial or not, it could remand it to the trial court. Another complication is that while this case has been pending since 2003, the petition was filed, Mr. Carter was placed on supervised release and then revoked for rule violations and back to San Andreas. There could be some new facts that would probably be relevant that a court should consider in deciding whether or not he gets a new trial. Also, Mr. Carter does have an evaluation pending before the trial court. Now, he hasn't filed a new petition for discharge yet, but he is potentially going to do that, depending perhaps on the criteria that has to be met based on this court's ruling.
Well, I'm reading your conclusion on page 31. You request that the court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals affirming the trial court's order denying the discharge petition, right?
Right.
And you want this court to order to remand this to the trial court, right?
Right.
With instructions to consider the application of the standards required to warrant a hearing under Hager and conduct a discharge trial. So why would they consider the application of the standards required to warrant a hearing when you think that he's entitled to a discharge trial?
Correct.
No. I'm saying, why don't you want us to just send it to the trial court to conduct a discharge trial?
I think the court could do that. The court chooses to evaluate the record, which the court has before it, and it could decide on the record, just like the Court of Appeals did for Hager, that he was entitled to a discharge trial. I am concerned that there might perhaps be enough new evidence that's come up between the time this case began and now that the state's going to be asking, in any event, for reconsideration based upon.
So if it goes back,
and supervised release, yes.
If it goes back, it has to consider, the trial court has to consider all the evidence up to the date of the trial court's consideration.
Right.
All right. Is there any way this court can manage to have inconsistent decisions in Carter and in Hager? That bothers me. You can see I'm bothered by what we have to do to make these cases, make the opinions consistent.
Well, our preference is that the court, in fact, just directly order a trial and not order a reconsideration. And I think looking at the facts of record that were established in Carter, the court could do that, looking at the criteria that was set forth in the Hager decision by the Court of Appeals, and applying that to this case. And both Hager and Carter had expert opinions, just different psychologists that were well known to do Chapter 98 cases. So I think that's
The Court of Hager is before this court. Maybe this court's going to not agree with the Court of Appeals in Hager, right?
That's certainly a possibility.
Right. Then what do we do?
Then I would say is send it back to the trial court for consideration under whatever the correct criteria is.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Donald Badaraka appears on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. In Mr. Carter's case, Mr. Carter raises several constitutional claims, and the state asks that this court holds as follows, that with respect to the retroactivity or the application of Act 84 to a petition that was filed, that is a claim of one of ineffective assistance of counsel, and that counsel was not ineffective for failing to argue what is really, I think, shows from the debate, a point of unsettled law, but at least in the best case scenario, it's unsettled. The state believes it's actually settled in the state's favor here, and that is this. Whether we look at this Act 84 as a, when we look at the provisions on how to review the discharge petition, it's either prospective or retroactive. It's retroactive in the sense that it's a new rule that applies to the determination of a pending petition. And under that analysis, there's no vested right because Judge Kelly had not yet decided the petition. He had not decided, not even considered whether the petition was enough to get to a Parens 2 review. So it didn't affect a vested right. That is, the right only vests to a discharge trial once a judge does the review under Parens 1 and then 2 and decides that a person has met the criteria to get that trial. And then, alternatively, putting aside the vested rights analysis, there was no undue hardship for Mr. Carter in this case. The petition was filed on the date of publication. The effective date was the following day. So it's not as though Mr. Carter had invested a great amount of energy and work into this process such that it would be unfair to apply the new standard to him. And again, I want to say that even under looking at under the Trinity Petroleum, or more recently, this court's approach in the Land's End case, one could even under that case suggest that this was not retroactive at all because no judgment had been made about whether or not Mr. Carter's petition met the criteria for a discharge trial. Moving forward on the other issues, and that is this, his due process claims. Do Act 84's changes, amendments to the discharge petition process, violate Mr. Carter's procedural or substantive due process rights? The state says no. With respect to procedural due process, Act 84 doesn't violate procedural due process. Act 84's changes give Mr. Carter an opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time and meaningful place. They can be seen as promoting an efficient administration of justice, while at the same time providing someone like Mr. Carter an opportunity to ask the court to review his current status of being confined.
Counsel, you say at page 6 of your brief that the revised procedure serves the state's interests by more efficiently weeding out unmeritorious petitions than the previous procedure and reserving trials for those who have a reasonable probability of prevailing. I'm interested in whether it is possible for this revised procedure to weed out a meritorious petition.
In other words, that the error that might occur, a meritorious petition
might be denied a discharge trial.
And that's always a legitimate concern because when we're talking about commitments, this court has said since it reviewed the 980 statute post in the early cases that always wanted to make sure that people had appropriate remedies for release. I think that the standard that the state's previously articulated in this case and in Hager before this court will meet that goal. People are getting discharge trials, people who have been committed. They've been getting discharge trials even since this new law has been enacted. It has not become people have been getting discharged, too. So from that vantage point, it's the state believes that based on all of the procedures that are in play, including the annual review process in which an expert employed by the Department of Health Services does a review, and also the patient has the right under the statute to secure the services of counsel and an expert every time he petitions for discharge, I think there's robust tools or procedures in place to minimize that risk that someone will be improperly denied. I'm not going to sit here and say it could never happen because I think it could. But I think
let's focus on that piece for just a second. Then is the standard of constitutionality then that it could deny a meritorious petition, or is there a for lack of a better term, a grace zone where we say, yeah, we recognize this procedure could deny a discharge trial to a meritorious petition, but we don't think it's going to be a really high percentage, and so it's okay.
What I would say in that case, though, that's why we have a court of appeals, and that's why they are there to review those decisions and in appropriate cases, reverse, and I think looking at our Court of Appeals and the history of Court of Appeals decisions reviewing denials of discharge petitions and reversals, that they take that responsibility seriously. So,
and they do. And my concern is, and I'm not worried that they won't. My concern is that the standard that the court has to consider in determining whether to grant a discharge trial is the same standard that will control whether the person is discharged. So the potential error in granting a discharge trial could be that a person who was who a jury would have found does no longer meet the commitment standards is denied a trial.
What I would say is that in those in in those cases, and I guess my own experience, that that historically has not been a problem. But I can't say that it would never be a problem. And there's always a concern that if the court's absolutely right, that if the burden at this phase is elevated too high, such that it became, let's take the extreme, impossible. Someone, the pleading requirement was the person had to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not a sexually violent person. And the state's burden at trial is merely to show by clear and convincing evidence that the person is still sexually violent. That would be problematic, and we do not seek that kind
right.
of a...
So do you have any cases that would say that when the standard for granting a discharge trial is the same standard to determine whether he should be discharged, that there is no constitutional violation in those standards being the same?
Well, I'm not, first, from the state's vantage point, the state's not going to concede that the standard articulated in subsection 2 is the same standard for trial, I believe.
Okay, so what's the difference?
This is a hard question.
It's a good question.
Yes, I mean, I thought of this.
And as would likely, and this is where I think the word would likely has some bearing, the would, as opposed to clear and convincing evidence. Now, clear and convincing is a very clear standard, and it's very affirmative on the state. Would likely suggest that it's not absolutely guaranteed, but it's within the realm of possibility. It's more than the may conclude. We know that that's what that means, but it provides some level of saying there's a little meat here, and that's sort of the way the court gets to deciding whether someone should get that trial.
Did you understand that?
I don't. I think I'll have to think about that.
Yes. I mean, I think that's a very difficult question, and I think you just stand. I don't mean that you. I mean, we are dancing on the head of the pin with this. So really, the question is, as Justice Kelly indicated, you have the standard of would likely. How does that differ from clear, satisfactory, and convincing? Clearly, it's more than may, your response, and I don't know who can disagree with that. Clearly, it's more than may. But where in this spectrum of preponderance of evidence does would likely fit? Does would likely fit above preponderance and below clear, satisfactory, and convincing? Does it fit right with clear, satisfactory, and convincing, and then it's the very same thing? Does it fit a little bit above clear, satisfactory, and convincing, but less than reasonable doubt? What's the answer to my question, counsel?
Well, I would go back to the language of the statute, and of course, that was one of the debates that occurred in Ahrens.
Yeah, but the problem is this. Makes no sense constitutionally or from my perspective of common sense to have the same thing tried twice. And the question is, with your interpretation of the amended statute, are you really trying the same thing twice?
Mm-hmm. No, the state's not. It's not. It's, I think it's a different assessment. I think the court is looking... Again, it's not making a credibility judgment at the Parens II phase. It's making a broad assessment. Is there something here that's new, that's favorable, that pushes back on that original commitment finding? And would likely, if we go to the language of the statute, likely means more likely than not. The legislature didn't use preponderance, and of course, and so it is. It's a different. It's different from the standard that the burden the state meets at a trial, which is clear and convincing evidence.
All right. So maybe you can let me just set up how I look at this, and you can tell me where I'm mistaken. So as you say, the state has the burden to establish that the petitioner still meets the conditions for commitment by clear and convincing evidence. 980.09 says. The court's job in determining whether to grant a discharge trial is looking at that standard, clear and convincing. The court says, do I think it's likely that the petitioner is going to be able to push the state back further than clear and convincing? Or, put it in the converse, do I think it's likely that the state won't be able to prove its case by clear and convincing evidence? So we're looking at the same standard, right? I mean, that's what we're getting at. The trial court is trying to make a prediction about what the trier of fact is going to do. And the trier of fact has to say, is the evidence on the lee side or the weather side of that clear and convincing standard? So the court's making a prediction about what the jury will do with that standard. Isn't that the way it's set up?
Well, and as the court recalls from this morning, that's one reason we advocated for a standard that's analogous to newly discovered evidence, where the court is looking at the old evidence, the evidence that resulted in the most recent commitment determination, and it's asking the question, is that new information that's being proffered in support of discharge,
right,
is it of such a nature that it would cause a trier of fact to have to reach a different conclusion?
Right. So that the new evidence, that describes the quantum, or it describes the parameter of the evidence that we're considering, right? So when we say we look at new evidence, that describes the parameter of the new of the evidence that we are considering, and saying, is there enough distance between that and, you know, and what was the case before to warrant a prediction that the trier of fact will find the state does not met its burden of clear and convincing evidence, right? So that it's a difference between describing the evidence that we look at on the one hand, and on the other, describing how we look at what that evidence means. And what it means is, are you on the weather or the lee side of clear and convincing evidence? Isn't that how it's set up?
I'm not sure it's quite the same. I think it's different. Precisely because we don't want, and we're making it clear, we're not asking judges, they're accepting that new evidence is true.
Okay, so it's
we're not making, that's one reason why we step back from weighing, because we don't think it's appropriate at this phase to have these credibility determinations being made.
Okay, so also, then, please go ahead.
Also, isn't it true that what we are doing with this particular part of the proceeding is trying to predict what a jury may do, but when we get to the actual jury, there's going to be a lot of evidence, and the burden is on the state by clear and convincing evidence at that moment, not at some time in the future, but right now, is the person still a sexually violent person, correct? So you're in two different time spans and with much different evidence, I would think. Or am I looking at it incorrectly?
No, I think that's true. At the time of trial, it's very clear there will be, the state's going to have to reprove its case. It can't rely on the information from the previous trial. It's not doing that. It has the obligation, the affirmative obligation, to satisfy a burden of proof, and that means it has to come forward with affirmative evidence that demonstrates today this man has a mental disorder that predisposes him to engage in acts of sexual violence, and today that the risk of that person, the risk of this committed person will reoffend is one of more likely than not.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
And because we don't weigh evidence, then are we saying that the courts must set aside evidence that detracts from the petitioner's petition?
It depends on what evidence we're talking about. If it's the evidence from the original, from the previous trial, the statute requires the court to assess change, and the only way of, so it's got to look at that reference point. That reference point was the last trial, and if the expert's
opinion is grounded basically on, is basically old wine in a new bottle, just a rehash of the type of information that was presented previously. I think a court in that case could say this is not a situation where a trier of fact would likely conclude that the individual is no longer sexually violent,
sure.
Even though they're not weighing it. They're saying
yeah.
This was information that a trier of fact had the opportunity to consider.
Right, already considered.
And therefore it made a credibility assessment about that kind of information.
Right. So let's say new wineskin, and presented by the petitioner, and the state says, wait, there's other new evidence, and here it is, and it's conflicting with that. And so we've got two wineskins, they're both new, and they both have new wine in them, right? So do we just set aside the state's wineskin and just concentrate on the petitioners?
I somehow knew you would return to this afternoon. The statute, the language of the statute doesn't use the word favor. And as the Court of Appeals did when it reviewed the case, it says that the court's to look at it's supposed to look at everything, and it looks at any current or past reports filed under 980.07. So my concern is that type of interpretation would basically undermine or insert language into the statute. You look at current reports that are favorable to an individual. That is the challenge of interpreting this statute, that it doesn't draw a distinction or parse out between favorable or unfavorable current reports.
Yeah, so help me write the opinion on this. So there's conflicting new evidence, and you are writing the opinion, and you say this is what the court should do with that conflicting evidence in deciding whether a discharge trial is warranted. What do you say?
Are we writing the Hager decision or the Carter decision on constitutionality?
They better be consistent with each other. So let's assume they will be.
What I would say is, looking at the language of the statute, and the court is bound by the language of the statute, that it has to take into account current reports. And those reports include reports that may not be favorable. Now, that doesn't mean that a court should ignore the information that a patient is proffering in support of the commitment, as long as it fits within, as long as it's reasonably reliable in the sense of it's based on a reasonable understanding of the facts and the application of appropriate legal principles to the case. If it chooses to weigh heavily but put a lot of emphasis on the state's report, then it's going to run afoul of, I think, the situation where the court's supposed to look at what about this information that's being offered that shows substantial change, because that is the primary focus of the court in looking at the issue. And so as I'm hearing myself speak and thinking about it, we're going back to the words substantially change. And if that information that's being proffered shows or demonstrates substantially change, the circuit court needs to look at that and needs to and can't disregard it casually or lightly.
And in that regard, you are at odds with both Court of Appeals opinions, because both Court of Appeals opinions indicate that you examine the record to see if there is a, and I'll use this term loosely, new factor as opposed to comparing the evidence.
I didn't have my copy of Carter this morning. The court you referred to.
Paragraph 20, I think.
Paragraph 20. And the criticism of paragraph 20 is the language and the facts favorable to the petitioner contained in the record. Again, it just says the facts favorable to the petitioner contained in the record without any reference to, again, I don't want to rehash this morning's arguments, but it doesn't reference, when we say facts favorable, we're only talking about when facts that were favorable that were presented at the last trial or new facts that are being presented with the new report.
So you have no problem with that part of paragraph 20 in this case that indicates the record review under 980 is 09 is primarily designed to ensure that the petition alleges new and probative information that has not yet been presented to a fact finder.
I think that that sentence is a reasonable. That sentence is not an unreasonable sentence. It's a sentence that this I accept. It's the sentence before that that's problematic because it only talks about looking at favorable, and the one issue with the new and probative information that has not yet been presented, it has to be, again, that sentence at least is going back to our reference point, the last event at which a trier of fact got the opportunity to consider everything that was being presented by both parties, make some credibility determinations, and to decide that the person still meets criteria.
That's the rub of it, isn't it? In part, but the scope of this review is of the record, how you do it.
Mm-hmm. The other point that I would make, and that has to do with the substantive due process analysis. In this case, there's a discussion, a debate between the parties as to whether strict scrutiny or rational basis test should apply to these statutes. And it's the state's position that these changes are to the procedure, and that while anything associated with Chapter 980 has some effect on someone's liberty interest, right?
Don't be so bold.
But the question is whether or not, but the whole point of the early cases, Post and so on, dealt with whether or not the scheme itself, which provided for commitment, provided procedures, provided for discharge, and so on, that went to the fundamental liberty interest. When we're talking about procedural aspects here, what's the standard that someone must meet to get a trial? It is a rational basis test that applies. And the state relies on the Alger case, which is a case dealing with whether or not the Daubert evidentiary standard applied to a Chapter 980 case that had been filed before. Before the Daubert change, the rule of evidence had become operative. And so, in this case, the pleading standard is not something that's arbitrary and that has no, it bears no rational relationship to a legitimate government interest. So, under those circumstances, for the reasons that my colleague, Mr. Balistrieri, articulated in the brief, this is an appropriate situation where the rational basis analysis applies. So my time is almost up, and unless the court has any specific more questions, I will end my argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd ask the court to consider this hypothetical, which I think is probably quite realistic. Somebody has a fact-finding determination and has 4 years of reviews where the state keeps saying that he's a sexually violent person based upon the static 99R and other actuarial instruments the state traditionally uses. At the same time, this individual is engaged in the classes that are available at Sandridge, phase one, phase two, phase three. And there's a disagreement between the state evaluator and a new expert that's hired by the respondent that whether or not he's internalized what he's supposed to learn in these and whether or not he's a risk if he gets released or not. So there would be certainly new behavior, although I think there would be more if it's talking about behavior where somebody has learned something in their different phases and classes that they have at Sandridge is better than just general kind of behavior changes that were utilized in Tally, which this court decided earlier this year. I think certainly we have to avoid weighing. I think a person in that situation deserves a trial. We have to avoid using weighing the experts against each other and let the jury decide whether or not he's internalized it like his expert says when he's gone through those classes and that sort of experience. So I think that's important that we not allow weighing by the judges of other criteria. There's another question which I'm not even sure I know the answer to, but the question of Mr. Carter, I can see the court grants Mr. Carter a trial, and then the state files a petition asking the court to consider new evidence that it has that Mr. Carter has, was on supervised release and he got revoked because he had unauthorized contact with an adult female, and whether or not that would change the whole process, and then the trial could be canceled or not, or does he have the right to a trial once it's ordered? I take the position he had the right to a trial when it's first ordered, and he'll need to consider whether he wants to actually get through the trial, given the fact that there might be that kind of evidence against him. Whether that kind of evidence may or may not be significant. But again, I think it's important perhaps the court to consider that possibility if the state can present new evidence that's unfavorable, and whether the court has to consider that and whether or not the trial goes forward after it's been scheduled. I think that could very easily happen in Carter's case. I would agree with the court, and especially with Justice Justice Kelly. And besides that, he has a similar last name, not spelled exactly the same as the judge in this case. Then we do need to make sure that I think to have due process is that we don't block meritorious petitions from going into the system when you're committed under Chapter 980. Now, simply, it's not a consideration of the court in any one decision, but we know it costs a lot of money, about $140,000 or so every year for a Chapter 980 patient. There's also a question of allocation of state resources if it's necessary or not necessary in a particular case, as well as the fact that it's simply a deprivation of freedom and liberty. So I think that's the important thing we want the court to consider in this case, something that will work effectively for Mr. Carter in ensuring his due process rights, as well as weeding out meritorious or weeding out meritless petitions. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for continuing sort of the argument that we had this morning. It's very helpful to have two cases when you're looking at a new piece of statute and how we're going to apply it, and it's important how it's applied. So I thank you very much for the argument. We will be adjourning, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:00. We are adjourned.